Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, whose new novel, his first, is We Cast a Shadow. Watch out, world. New Orleans' own Maurice Ruffin debuts his first novel, We Cast a Shadow, this week. It's already on every must-read list for January, from Goodreads to Cosmopolitan, and even for the year of 2019, so you have a lot to look forward to. Maurice is an award-winning creator of short stories and essays, a native New Orleanian, a graduate of the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop, a practicing attorney, a restaurateur, I hope I didn't leave anything out, but now we can add to that, critically acclaimed novelist. Maurice Ruffin, it is such a pleasure to have you on The Reading Life.
Susan, I'm so happy to be here. Since this show started, I've dreamed of this moment, and here we are doing it.
So. I know, I'm so excited. Now, We Cast a Shadow is set in a futuristic southern city, which seems a little familiar to me because of the avenue of streetcars, just a little bit. So, it's a frightening place to live. It's a city maybe 50 years in the future.
Yes.
So talk about what went into creating this entire world, because once you begin to read the novel, you're in this world.
Right. Well, you know, New Orleans informs the book, obviously. I think I was originally inspired by Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading that book in college and thinking that this book so perfectly describes how it feels to be an African-American in America. And I think that around the time that Trayvon Martin was killed, those conversations around what happened to him, his murder, sort of combined in my mind. And I decided that I wanted to pursue that path and write a book about a very American city with a very American problem.
So it's been a long and winding road writing this book for you, hasn't it?
It has. It has. It's been sort of a hero's journey. You know, you start out and you struggle. And I was lucky enough to find good people to sort of lead me and help me along the path. And here I am, years and years later.
You first started in 2007, was that it?
Well, give or take. I mean, it depends on when you want to peg the beginning of it. But even back in 2003 or 4, I would go to coffee shops and just sort of write passages and see what came out.
Mm-hmm. And then when it really coalesced for you after Trayvon Martin?
I think so. I think my writing group, Podunk, who I've been with since 2007, as you mentioned, I would often test out pieces with them. And I think that it was such a safe space to create work. Around 2012 or 13, when I decided to pursue this particular book, I could immediately see the impact it was having on the people I read it to. They would say, you know, I've never really thought about that in that way. And so to have my friends give me that sort of space to express these thoughts was very, very helpful.
Talk a little bit about that group, because you all are really remarkable. You've lasted a long time. Mm-hmm. You've done some great things together. And we're seeing the results,
yeah.
The happy results now.
Yeah, Podunk Writers Alliance, we started in 2007. And the idea was, you know, there's so many of us writers in the world who are so, we write in isolation. And I think it's really important for writers to find their tribe. So yep. We met in Pirate's Alley in the French Quarter. It was a dark and stormy night.
Of course.
And we became fast friends and eventually family. And it's a bunch of people who've been involved since the very beginning, like Tad Bartlett and our friend Terry Strum, who passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
As well as other people like Emily Stad and April Blevins Pajic. And I think that we have really shown each other that as amateur writers, you can have that passion that allows you to publish pieces and win awards and publish books. And we're doing great. It's been wonderful.
And you all go away and have writer's camp every year, don't you?
Oh, yeah. We have a little writer's retreat. We have various meeting places. We joke that we have like a meeting place on the moon that we go to occasionally. But it's a yearly retreat that we do.
I think that's fantastic. It's so much fun to watch you all achieve success over time because you've all been so strong for each other.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is what you need.
You got to find your people to succeed as a writer, I think. And they're my people.
Well, you've made this complicated landscape in this southern city. You're predicting a bit of what will happen in our racial politics as a country. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that, about the challenges of creating those details and that landscape, because it's sadly not a very hopeful vision.
It's funny because when I was writing this, I kept thinking, how do you speak about the future? Obviously, it hasn't happened yet. And the more I've read about history, the more I realize that things really are in cycles. What's old is new and what's new is old. And so looking at the history of America with slavery and mass incarceration and Jim Crow, looking at what happened to Jewish folks in Europe, looking at other places all around the world, you see a lot of the same ideas being repeated by people who want to oppress. And so frankly, it was just a matter of me thinking about, okay, well, how would this play out in 50 years or so? And I sort of, and this is before the president was elected, I wasn't even thinking about him, but I kept thinking, what if things got really bad really quickly around this time, like 2016, 17, 18? And what would happen sort of leading out decades after that? And so this book is my idea about where things go if we don't watch ourselves.
So here we are. You've written a book of this moment.
Yeah.
And you began it 11 years ago.
Right.
Isn't that an amazing synchronicity for you?
It is. You know, sometimes you just sort of throw the football out and it lands lands in the right place.
So let's talk a bit about your protagonist. He's a high-powered lawyer at a really respected firm.
Nothing like me at all.
Nothing at all. Has a biracial marriage, a biracial son, and there's a central dilemma in his life. So I'd like you to talk about that dilemma.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that he is a father who loves his son. He is a husband who loves his wife. He is a family man who loves his family. And he is looking at his son, who is mixed race. Very light skin, and he's thinking about what does it mean for his son to present as a black boy in America. And obviously he's seen a lot of the things that's happened to other young black men and women, and he's wondering how to protect his child from some of those dangers, whether it's police brutality or problems at school or any other problems that come up. And the son has this birthmark on his face. He's very light skinned, so he could pass for white, but the birthmark is dark brown, and it's getting bigger as he gets older. And this is sort of the father's freaking out. And he's trying to figure out how to address this. Should he get rid of it? Should he try and hide it somehow? And that's sort of what sets the book off.
And the landscape now, we have like patrols. We are in this futuristic city. We have fenced-in ghettos.
Yes.
It's really a hostile landscape and one that would drive any parent to fear and worry and distraction. But he's a frustrating character, this lawyer,
you know,
because he's working so hard to get money together for this procedure. And he careens from one disaster to another. But what really makes you root for him as a person is this deep love for his son, this deep abiding tenderness that you capture so well.
Yes.
And I wonder if you'd read a little part of this for us.
Okay, this is from We Cast a Shadow. I am a unicorn. I can read and write. I have all my teeth. I've read Plato, Wolf, Nikki Giovanni, and Friend. I've never been to jail. I've voted in every election since I was 18. I finished high school. I finished college. I finished law school. I pay taxes. I don't have diabetes, high blood pressure, or the itis. If you randomly abduct 100 black men from the streets of the city and deposit us into a gas chamber, I will be the only one who fits this profile. I will be the only one who survives. Is it because I'm better than the other 99? No. It's because I'm lucky, and I know it. Somehow the grinding effects of a world built to hurt me have not eliminated my every opportunity for a happy life, as is the case for so many of my brethren. The world is a centrifuge that patiently waits to separate my Nigel from his basic human dignity. I don't have to tell you that this is an unjust planet. A dark-skinned child can expect a life of diminished light. This is true anywhere in the world and throughout most of history. But let's stick to the home of the free. Place young Jamal on an all-white basketball team, and guess who will get ejected from the game more often for normal, rambunctious behavior? Give a hiring manager a stack of applications and let him choose between an equally qualified Jamal, Jane, or Jonathan. See Jamal waiting at the unemployment office again. Admittedly, None of these examples are particularly shocking, and I fear that I risk insulting your intelligence, dear reader. But ride with me a while longer. See Jamal evicted from his apartment. See Jamal arrested for vagrancy. See Jamal mysteriously die in a transport van on the way to the city jail. A brief interlude of cursing the heavens. Resurrect Jamal with lightning. Smoke, sparks, the smell of burning cocoa butter. Put a toy in Jamal's hand in an open carry state. Wait for Jane or Jonathan to call the police due to a suspicious-looking black guy. See the cavalry show up and scalp Jamal. No questions asked. Jane is heartbroken for the tragic misapprehension of the situation, she says over a pumpkin spice latte, as Jonathan bites the tip of a double chocolate biscotti. I have a natural aversion to numbers and statistics, as they can be manipulated by any reactionary with an agenda. But that doesn't change the objective fact that prospects for African Americans have devolved even since my grandparents' time. Black women make 30 cents for every dollar a white man does. And 90% of black moms are single mothers. Unemployment among black males is the norm, not the exception, and 9 out of 10 brothers have done time. And virtually none of us black guys and dolls can vote, since felons and the children of felons need a voucher from some upstanding citizen to earn a voting pass. JoJo was mine. None of that even takes into account the fact that every black person is a de facto enemy of our state. They used to call bringing every able-bodied black male to jail for questioning, racial profiling, and now it's called excellent police work. And did I mention that blacks in most major cities live in fenced-in ghettos, just like the Tico? There may be beauty in my blackness and dignity in the struggle of my people, but I won't allow my son to live a life of diminished possibility. I see a constellation of opportunity that those of my ilk rarely travel to. I see my Nigel at the center of those stars.
A dark-skinned child can expect a world of diminished light. Hmm. Did you just stop yourself after you wrote that sentence?
You know, I feel like the narrator, these things came from him, and I really feel like it was almost channeling what he really felt in his life. And he would stop me quite often, and I would go, oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. I love that section. I do. And yeah, this is a book that is also very funny.
Yeah.
Very wild.
It is. He's
inventive.
A funny guy.
He is. He gets in a lot of trouble.
He does.
One thing that keeps coming up again is the idea of performance. This starts at a kind of savage cocktail party where a law firm is kind of sorting through its associates in the most brutal and terrible kind of way.
Really?
And then there are plays and press conferences, and it's set in such fraught locations, housing developments, shopping malls, plantations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you go there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's very brave. It's so interesting to me that you've packed all of this into one novel.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that I really wanted to do something that encompassed, I guess, the New Orleans experience as well as the Southern experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this region is so particular, and our stories are often caricatured. And I think that often in literature and even in film, if a plantation appears, it's often this sort of joyous, fun place, let's have a wedding here, that sort of thing. And I just wanted to create a more honest depiction of some of these scenarios. What does it feel like to be in a place where, you know, people were enslaved, you know, people who would have otherwise been free were forced to do grueling work to kill them often. And often people were raped or otherwise just brutalized. And so you wouldn't go into a cemetery and have a party. So why would you go to a plantation and have a wedding or a party? And so I think that this narrator is sort of thinking these things through, but he's also being moderated by the fact that he's trying to impress his bosses, impress his law firm coworkers so that he can help his son. He needs to raise money. And so he's being stretched and pulled in all directions at once.
He's a striver.
He is a striver. It's the American dream.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's an amazing thing. You know, James Baldwin said, to be black and conscious in America is to be in a constant state of rage.
Yes.
And more recently, people have added a kind of different word to that equation. To be black and conscious in America is to be in a state of exhaustion.
Yes.
And I think your book brings all of those things home to us. That's why it's so interesting to me that people are struggling to find words for it. Satire is semi-satirical.
Yeah.
Semi-satirical. Right. And parody. How do you think of this book?
You know, it's an interesting question. You're right. It's so strange to see these classifications, you know, semi-satirical, like a semi-sweet chocolate or something like that. I'm fine with calling it satire, but I know that satire is often considered to not have a heart. There's a coldness to it. And I think that, as you mentioned earlier, this narrator is not exhausted at all. Whenever he feels like he is reaching the end of his rope, he thinks about his son, or he thinks about his family, and he thinks about what's important to him. And that just rejuvenates him. So maybe it's satire, maybe it's parody, maybe it's literary fiction. To me, it's a story, and to me, it's a story that's designed to give you a 360-degree view of a person's life that we normally wouldn't see in literature or in film.
To me, it's a sign that when people are struggling for words to describe it, that you've done something new.
Yes, I am happy about that.
Very That's happy. The best thing of all, I think.
Yes.
I was thinking back over the books I've read this year that have meant the most to me, and I think your book and Kiese Lehmann's Heavy, an American Memoir, have given us two of the most brilliant depictions of what it's like to be an African-American man in America these days. Mm-hmm. Fiction, nonfiction. They're amazing documents, Maurice.
Oh, my goodness. You know, Kiese is such an amazing writer. And I mean, I consider him a mentor. I've been reading his work for years now. And to actually, you know, meet him and become friends with him, I think that his writing is so clear and so direct. He just doesn't play around at all. And I think he actually helped me write my book by reading some of his work, like Long Division or his essay collection, where you get into it and you understand that there's so many sort of mythologies that we can untangle. And by untangling those things, you free yourself up to be a better person, I think. And so Kiese is a big part of that. Justin Ward, Toni Morrison, Tagari Jones. I can go on and on and on. I've read their work and it's helped me so much.
You're a reader.
I am a reader, absolutely.
But how do you feel about that? How do you feel about that exhaustion of performance? It is something that we're starting to realize, I think, more completely in writing.
Well, I think that everybody has to perform sometimes. You know, sometimes parents don't feel like parents. Sometimes people who are in their jobs don't feel like they belong there for whatever reason. But I do think a big part of the Black experience in America is having that due consciousness that we've heard about, thanks to people like Du Bois and others.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I can say that it's not a put on. I think that often in my life, I've had to personally make decisions about how to present myself in a given situation. It's how I am in front of my family and friends and how I am, say, in a work setting. And I think that the narrator is dealing with an even more exaggerated version of it. He feels that if he slips up in his presentation, he'll you know, lose his job, lose his home, possibly be incarcerated, be physically harmed. And so for him, the stakes are high. And that's the case for many African-Americans in this country today. It's part of the experience.
Well, this is a novel that is designed to provoke discussion. I mean, you're not out to give any easy answers here. You're not even out to give answers, particularly.
Yes.
So what do you want readers to take away from it? What is your hope for this book? I think every book is a hope.
Yes.
So what do you want this book to do in the world?
Well, you know, I think that any good novel is something that asks questions. And so I do want people to read the book and kind of wonder why hadn't they thought about some of these things before. I think that education is so important in our lives. I'm a lifelong student. I've got several degrees because I love to learn about the world and about humans. But I do think that people should ask, why haven't they learned more about some of these things when they were either in high school or in grade school or even in college? I think that often history is sort of collapsed and reduced to the sort of simplified version of itself. And then you watch television and you see riots, or you see people being shot for no apparent reason, you wonder, why has it happened?
Mm-hmm.
I think that once you begin to read books like Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow,
right,
or you know, similar books like that, you get an impression for the things you have not learned in your life. And so I think that this book should be maybe a portal towards going on a personal journey to make yourself more intelligent and more empathetic on these topics.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I admire about you so much is that you're such a good and generous literary citizen.
Thank you.
You're a big part of the literary community here. You give readings, you read people's works, you're part of Podunk. You've just done a lot on your way to this book. And now it's like you're stepping out into a slightly larger community.
Mm-hmm.
And you had this great experience in November. You were part of a photo shoot for the New York Times T magazine style section. And you were one of 32 important African-American writers, male writers in this magazine. So what was it like for you to step into that room?
Oh, my goodness.
With those writers. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about what that meant to you.
I felt like Forrest Gump. I feel like I had been like digitally inserted into the scenery. It was amazing. I mean, there were just so many amazing writers there. There were multiple Pulitzer Prize winners and the multiple National Book Award winners and people who I had read in high school or in college. And frankly, we were together for maybe 8 or 9 hours that day for the photo shoot. And I just felt like I was dreaming the entire time I was there. Like I just had been hit in the head and knocked out, and I was in a bed somewhere and this wasn't really happening.
Who was it a particular thrill for you to meet?
You know, I hadn't thought I'd ever get to meet Ismael Reed, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Who is such an amazing and fiery writer. He's somebody who, you know, way back in the day, him and Toni Morrison would sort of tango over different issues. But then later, I mean, even in the past 4 or 5 years, they've done events together.
And they would even tango over certain issues in New Orleans.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, he's in his 80s now, and yeah. He is just so incredibly sharp. And I hope that I can be as sharp as he is when I'm in my 80s or even in my, you know, 50s or so.
So that must have been the icing on the cake for all this.
Absolutely. And so many cool people. James McBride was there, his work is incredible. And he was so down to earth. I didn't know it was him until like an hour after I met him. And somebody says, hey, that's James. I'm like, oh, my goodness.
Wow. So how have you managed to do this? How have you managed to do all these things over these years? You're a lawyer. Mm-hmm. You're busy. How have you made time for your writing?
You know, I am very busy, but I think that what I notice is that we all have some slack in our lives. You know, when I was a young man, I played a lot of Xbox and PlayStation. I've been involved in politics. I've played music in my life a little bit with groups and that sort of thing. And I recognize that if I just focus more on what I was really, what gave my life the most meaning, I recognize that writing, literature, is such an important part of my personal journey. The more I gave to it, the more it gave back to me. And so now, you know, instead of, you know, just sitting and staring at the TV for an hour, I'll write for an hour. I don't write every day. I don't have to. I don't think I need to. But I do have ideas that I want to bring out into the world. And seeing these things happen has been such a great blessing in my life.
So is the path to the second novel clear to you now?
You know, it's not clear until it's clear. I will say that just like with this novel and anything that I've written, whether it's been short stories or essays,
yeah,
the process is usually I have this sort of vague image in the back of my mind. And as I write it, the voice emerges. And once that person's voice comes out, even if it's my own modified voice, like a personal essay, once I find that, it's kind of off to the races. Mm-hmm. I can just sort of follow that contrail through the sky. You know, what is it, Peter Pan's second star on the right till morning?
Yep.
And next thing you know, I'm in Never Never Land.
Wow. Well, one of the other things I admire about you is that you have a lot of strings to your bow, as they say. I mean, you write commentary, you write short stories. You wrote that wonderful piece with Tad Bartlett and Kasimu Harris in The Bitter
That's
Southerner.
My brother Tad Bartlett, yeah.
Yeah, for your brother from another mother.
Yeah.
And about going to Selma.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you talk a little bit about the different kinds of demands of different kinds of writings, because you are taking on a responsibility in every one.
Absolutely. You know, I've had so many great mentors who've showed me the way over the years. For example, John Biganay, who's a professor at Loyola, he once told me when we were talking, he said, you know, his father was a carpenter who could build an entire house by himself. He could do the studs and the foundation and the walls and, you know, paint the place up. And he, as a writer, has done, you know, radio plays and novels and short stories. And I was so intrigued by the idea of trying different forms.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've done that. Another mentor of mine's Wells Tower, who's done a short story collection called Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned. He said that even if you're writing about yourself, you can have different angles on how you think about yourself. And yet one more mentor, Matt Johnson, said there are these big incidents in your life that you sort of go back to. You can't avoid them. You can sort of slice them finer and finer and make a different sort of dish for the public to receive. And so taking those ideas together and trying to write, for example, personal essays that are very personal, very honest, very direct, but have sort of an expansive view on what I'm trying to say about the world, it feeds my short stories. And those feed my novel.
Mm-hmm.
Without writing flash fiction, for example, I couldn't have written my short stories because I would have this little one-page story that kind of blows up into a 20-page story. So it's all connected.
Everything leads to something else.
Absolutely. There's no wasted effort at all. Even those things you bury on the side are still going to find a use somehow.
Well, those dear readers are going to be along for the ride for the long haul.
Oh, yeah. Get ready. I'm coming for you.
Well, we've been talking with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, whose brilliant new novel is We Cast a Shadow. You can meet him January 29th at 6 at the Ace Hotel's Three Keys. Maurice, congratulations on this fine book, and thank you so much.
What a great pleasure, Susan. Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, fiddler, poet, and storyteller Ken Waldman presents his show Donald Trump is My Muse, Monday, January 28th at 7 at Art Club NOLA, 1941 Arts Street. Tickets at artclub.org. The French Literature Discussion Group begins Alexandre Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo, Monday, January 28th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The reading for that first meeting is chapters 1 through 27. Marion Moore reads from and signs her first book of poems, Louisiana Midrash, Tuesday, January 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. Maurice Carlos Ruffin debuts his novel We Cast a Shadow, Tuesday, January 29th from 6 to 9 at a party. This includes an interview with his editor, Victory Matsui. That's at the Ace Hotel's Three Keys, 600 Carondelet. The Jefferson Parish Library presents its first Digital Expo, Tuesday, January 29th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Digital Expo is designed to explain how to enjoy the library's free digital content. That includes ebooks, audiobooks, music, movies, magazines, and comics. All can be delivered directly to a patron's device, smartphones, laptops, smart TVs, and tablets. Latrina Graves McCarty discusses and signs Olivia's Journey, Saturday, February 2nd at 1 at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Ashley Young facilitates a workshop, Writing Memoir Through Ancestral Narratives, Mondays in February from 6:30 to 9 at the Dragonfly. That's on St. Claude Avenue. For registration and tuition information, email info@noladragonfly.com. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library are sponsoring the inaugural Alvar Zine Contest. 2019's theme is Mardi Gras. Make a zine about carnival history, a story that takes place during Mardi Gras, personal memory, or a reflection on how the season makes you feel. To enter, submit a print copy of your zine to any New Orleans Public Library location. Electronic submissions, including your name, email, or phone number, and an attachment of your zine, may be submitted to contest@nolalibrary.org. The winner receives a Visa gift card and will have 100 copies of their zine printed and distributed at the New Orleans Comics and Zine Festival in April. All entries received will be added to the Alvar Zine Library. The winner will be notified Monday, April 1st. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for the Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.